This is Bondi Tunes International broadcasting around the world, and we welcome our listeners on FM in Australia and New Zealand. Bob McKenzie joins me from Dublin in Ireland. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Welcome to you too, Henry.
Whatever did happen to Bruce Springsteen?
Bruce Springsteen. Do you know, I mean, he's just the gift that keeps giving, isn't he?
Of course he is.
I mean, as you know, I am a massive, massive fan of Springsteen, and I've been going on all his tours since the Born in the USA tour in '85. So, a long time fan. Next summer, when I see him, will be shows number 54 and 55 for me. I've seen him all over Europe. I've also seen him in the States. I'm a big, big fan. But he's just released a very interesting album called Only the Strong Survive. And a lot of people have been quite sniffy about it because, of course, Rod Stewart, for instance, has spent the last 20 years doing the Great American Songbook. Now, basically what this album is it's an album of 15 soul covers. And basically what it is it's songs that Springsteen sang before he was Springsteen, if you know what I mean. So basically before he had all these wonderful songs that he and his band could sing, he sang the classics in the pubs and the bars of New Jersey and New York. Basically that's what this is. So he decided to do this album, and it's absolutely brilliant, I have to say. It just came out last Friday. He is, of course, about to start a tour early next year. He begins in the States in February. He'll be over here in Europe in the spring. He's here in Dublin on early May. And it just so happens that the two gigs I'm going to, one of them is the day before my birthday, one of them is the day after my birthday, and Bruce is taking the night off for my birthday, which I think is very good of him.
It's very, very decent of him. Do you often wonder why a lot of the older singers, let's say, that they still hold... I mean, I know that you know, Bruce Springsteen is kind of your musical god, but just generally speaking, why the likes of Rod Stewart...
Bar Elvis, he would be, yeah. I mean, Elvis. Mm. Elvis will forever be at the top of the pantheon. No. For obvious reasons, because it was my first musical love. Also, the fact that Elvis is, for me, the only artist I can think of who could sing any genre. He did it all from opera to gospel and back again. He was just an incredible vocal talent, shall we say. I mean, himself and Sinatra were the two greatest interpreters of other people's songs of the 20th century, without a shadow of a doubt. But Springsteen, I saw him first in '85. And I've been hooked ever since. I think I've missed one tour, which was the Seeger Sessions, which was when he went on the road doing all Pete Seeger's old songs and a lot of American folk songs. And that was because he only did one gig in Dublin and it sold out in like 10 seconds. And of course, he sells out very, very quickly. As soon as he announces that he's going on tour, I had people in the UK trying to source me tickets while I tried to source them tickets as well. So, you know, there's a great camaraderie between us tramps, as we like to be known, because tramps like us, baby, we were born to run. So we try and help each other out trying to get tickets. And of course, there's been a big controversial thing over Springsteen's ticket sales because they weren't capped. Over here, they were. In Ireland, we were fine. I paid €140 per ticket. Mm-hmm. Which is, I don't know what that would be in Australian money, but it's expensive. But
that's like $260 in Australia, which seems expensive to me.
Springsteen is different to any other act in the world because he does at least 3 hours because he has such a fantastic back catalogue, and he never does the same show twice. Like he's not one of these guys who has a set list and he sticks to it. He will change the set list every single time he goes out on that stage. So you can see him two or three nights in a row, and every night it's a different vibe, it's a different show, there's a different feeling. And that's why I think he's so special.
When you go to these concerts, and I'm talking more recently, not back in 1985, what sort of demographic is in the audience? I mean, do you see young people in the audience?
Yes. Not as many as you would like. I think that's fair to say. But you see, the thing about it is that over the last 5 years, Springsteen is finally getting his due, I think, in the pantheon of American singer-songwriters, and he's now rated up there with the likes of Bob Dylan, which is exactly as it should be, because for me, he is one of the great American songwriters alongside Bob Dylan. And the stuff that he's done in the last few years, he's been very, very prolific. He did a Broadway show that was only supposed to run for a month and ran for 18 months.
Oh, my God.
He did the Western Stars album, which was a solo album, which is full of absolutely beautiful California soft rock tracks with a full orchestra that he recorded in his barn at Colts Neck in New Jersey. He's also brought out an album with the E Street Band, Letter to You. And as soon as I heard the album, I thought to myself, this album is meant to be played live. So we're looking forward to hearing a lot of these new songs next year on the tour, Henry. But the great thing about it is that Springsteen is one of these guys, he's very collaborative in terms of if there's somebody at one of his gigs that he thinks the crowd might like to see, he will bring them up. Now, he gave me one of the greatest moments of my gig-going career in 1993 at the RDS in Dublin when he brought on the great Jerry Lee Lewis.
Oh,
I will never ever forget it. I was 10 feet away from Jerry Lee Lewis.
Amazing.
And I mean, you know, that is a bonus, whatever way you want to look at it. You can talk about what a bad man Jerry Lee Lewis was, but alongside the likes of Chuck Berry, Elvis, he was one of the godfathers of rock and roll. So to see that man up close, even just for a few minutes, was just spectacular for me, you know, because I'm such a student of the music, if you like, and you know me, I love my music. So to see somebody like him, and then you've got the flip side of it. When he's playing in Dublin and he brings Bono up, and then Bono rips the arse out of one of his songs and ruins the gig for me.
Yeah, are you a fan of Bono?
I'm not a fan of Bono, but I'm a fan of U2. I love U2 as a band. I think Bono is an absolute pox. Mm-hmm. I have been mistaken for him on holiday on far too many occasions to catalogue, which is very distressing for me.
I'm sure.
So bad that one of my friends said that if he ever met Bono, he would say to him, "Who do you think you are, Bob McKenzie?" So, you know, it's got that bad over the years. But Bono keeps really poor company. And he also makes ridiculous statements. And, of course, at the moment, he's got his autobiography out, which is going to sell by the wheelbarrow. I've been running it on my book club. As I said, love U2 as a band, one of the greatest live bands of all time, without a shadow of a doubt, up there even with the great Springsteen for me as a live act. And of course, they went through that run of albums, late 80s, right the way through the 90s, where they just couldn't put a foot wrong. And it was some of the most fantastic work that any Irish band has ever done. But Bono himself, you can keep him as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'm interested to ask.
With a great band, but he needs to shut his gob, to be honest.
Yeah, I one thing that irks me about Bono is that, by the way, that book you're talking about, he's spruiking it all over the nighttime shows, TV shows in America at the moment. The thing about Bono that has always annoyed me is that he's always been on the tails of Bob.
Yes, of course, Bob Geldof. Yes. The Boomtown.
Sorry, I should have made that clear. But well, I always found that, you know, back in the 80s with Live Aid and that stuff like that. And all the political stuff.
No, like... I mean, let's put it this way. Like, I've met Bob a couple of times. And
so have I actually.
I actually once, bizarrely, in my hometown in England, many, many years ago, before I even moved to Ireland, I was working in a hotel and I was on my break and I went across the road and it was a seaside town. And there was a cafe across the road that I go to for a cup of coffee called the Lobster Pot, which, of course, is a lovely name when you're down by the sea. And it was a very wet and windy day and the rain was hopping off the window. And I went in there and the only other people in there were Bob and Paula.
And are you kidding me?
Peaches was a baby at the time. They used to live in Faversham, which is a few miles up the coast from Deal, which is where I'm from in the southeast of England. And I spent a very happy hour sat there talking to Bob about this, that, and the other, you know. And obviously, because I have family in Bob's neck of the woods. You know, the conversation moved quite easily, as you can imagine.
What did you talk about?
We talked about Deal. We talked about Kent. We talked about Ireland, and you know the emigrant experience, if you like, about how hard it was, you know, to get things done if you were Irish in England at that time. This was the late '70s, early '80s, of course. So this would probably been about 83, 84, maybe. So it was just before Bob did Live Aid. It was about 18 months before he came up with the brilliant idea of Do They Know It's Christmas? And then Live Aid, obviously, the following summer. So very interesting guy, Bob. And I mean, I would agree with you to an extent, but what I would say to you is that Bono, at the risk of being, you know, sued completely, Bono is very much, you know, what we would call a star fecker in terms of he collects names, doesn't he? I mean, like, he's friends with people like Tony Blair and George Bush.
Yes.
There's no reason for that man to be friends with two war criminals.
Mm.
You know, there's no reason for it. He's been photographed shaking hands with Putin. You know, he's been involved in things that he shouldn't be involved in. And as well as that, you were talking about the way that he's shilling this book across all the American talk shows.
Mm.
He's also doing a Bruce, because Bruce, of course, famous, as we were saying, did that Broadway show where he did a few tunes and told a few stories. That's what Bono's doing with the book. He's going to do a few shows. So he did one in San Francisco the other night, and the critic absolutely panned it. So you can imagine the reception he's going to get in Ireland when he does it. He will probably get absolutely hammered. I mean, we're already fed up about the book, and it's only just out, Henry. So, I think the book will sell very, very well. It will probably be the number one seller for Christmas, certainly in this country. But I would be very, very surprised if some idiot doesn't send it to me for Christmas, knowing that I don't want it. Same as last year.
Just to piss you off, right?
When Springsteen and Obama brought the book out, my cousin bought it for me at great expense just to piss me off because he knew I didn't want it. So there you go. But, you know, Bono's Bono, isn't he?
Yeah, well, you know, he's been around a long time. But I just found him very, you know, he was really lazy in these interviews at the talk shows in America. It's like he couldn't be bothered almost, you know, and there was this sense.
What is it with the cheap hair dye from Superdrug? What is going on? He looks like me granny got a bad hair dye.
I didn't actually notice that.
It's like the brilliant line from the great Boy George, who of course is in your neck of the woods at the moment doing I'm a Celebrity. Mm. And he once made a great gag about Elton John. He said, Elton John, all that money and still has hair like a dinner lady. which is exactly how I feel about Bono's hair, to be honest.
Oh dear! I want to ask.
As you know, Henry, yes. I have a very fine head of hair, so I can make these comments. You
indeed,
know?
You can. You can afford to do so. I just wanted to ask you generally about, you know, I live in a very young suburb, if you like. The demographic is young, and they have a party. Well, they had a party the other night, and they were playing nothing but 70s and 80s music, and you have to wonder. I mean, you know, I don't want to sound old-fashioned with this, but why aren't they playing Rihanna and stuff like that? Why is it always 70s and 80s music? What do you think?
Because 70s and 80s music is much better than the rubbish that they come up with today. It's as simple as that.
But they might just think that we're being, you know, old fuddy-duddies saying this, but the thing is they might, you know, they might think that we are that, but they're still using the music from our era.
Listen, Henry, you know yourself, like the great music is great music. It doesn't matter what era it comes from.
Mm.
I mean, you listen to music now from the 80s, say, right?
Mm.
And you listen to the Human League.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Human League, their music still sounds as brilliantly fresh as it did in the 80s when they first released it. Yes. And it's the same with a lot of bands from that era. Their music has stood the test of time. Same with a lot of the bands from the 70s, the likes of Led Zepp and, you know, Elton John is still dining out on his stuff that he did in the 70s. the man hasn't done anything new in 30 years. It's like Stevie Wonder. Stevie Wonder is one of the best known musicians and performers in the history of music. The man hasn't released an album in 30 years.
Should they be doing that, Bob?
I think it depends on the quality of what they've done. I mean, Springsteen is one of those who has constantly mixed it up over the years. I mean, we were talking about that earlier, about the fact that, you know, he's been so prolific these last few years since just before lockdown, and he's tried new stuff, and he's kept reinventing himself, if you like. Whereas people like Elton, they're just going to take the money and do, you know, the final farewell tour. I mean, Elton has done at least three farewell tours, as far as I'm
aware. I was going to say, yes.
And, you know, Elton is not what he was. Let's be fair. Let's be honest. The voice isn't there anymore. His songs will forever stand the test of time. Elton John is one of the greatest singer-songwriters that the UK has ever produced. He's not quite David Bowie, but then again, who is? But he is, from that era, one of the greatest that the UK have ever produced. And, of course, himself, Bowie, Rod Stewart, they were all around the scene around the same time with the Beatles and that. And they all knew each other very, very well. They've all known each other for 60, 70 years.
Yeah, crazy.
I mean, there's a great story about, did you hear the story about Rod Stewart and Elton John and the Christmas presents?
No.
This is a really good story. Rod and Elton are very old friends. They even call each other by female names. They're that good as friends. I think Rod calls Elton Doris. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this one Christmas anyway, Rod decided that he'd push the boat out. And so he got the Christmas present for Elton, sent it over to him, and the Christmas present that he got for Elton was a diamond-encrusted fridge with some bolly in it, right?
Yeah.
And he spent, you know, I don't know, a few thousand on this, you know? Mm. Then he gets the gift from Elton. It's a £1 million Picasso.
My God.
Now, that shows you about Elton John. Mm. It's opulence with Elton.
Well, yes.
Do you know what I mean? And like Rod said, it like his jaw genuinely hit the floor when he saw what Elton had given him for Christmas. £1 million Picasso. Madness.
But do you think that it you know, money matters at all to these people? I mean, they're multimillionaires, obviously. I would even put a B in front of heirs. Money probably doesn't matter, but it's probably something that they're having a laugh with each other, you know. As you say, they're really good friends.
Well, I mean, the thing about Elton John is that, you know, as is famously been documented, the man used to spend $250,000 a year on flowers. So, you know, Elton has always been, you know, one of those who was... Elton is sort of like Liberace without the great outfits, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Liberace would be very similar to Elton John in terms of, you know, the way that he would gift things to people and blah, blah. Elvis was the same. I mean, Elvis would give strangers Cadillacs.
Yes, know? I heard that, yes.
So, you know, they're a different beast, aren't they? Mm. You know, these rock stars are a completely different beast to you and I.
And if you look at... young people now, do you think, like, let me ask you this. Do you have any, are you a fan of any of the current people in the top 20, let's say, the top 20 charts, like Rihanna and the likes? Are you a fan of any of these people of this genre?
I would have a lot of time for Taylor Swift, because I think she's a very, very clever songwriter. She also, because of the way that she is fighting the record companies for her own music to be owned by her, so I have a lot of time for her as both a campaigner and as an artist.
Is she the artist formerly known as Taylor?
That's her. Yes. but she's on tour at the same time as Springsteen. He was asked last night on Fallon, will he be going to see Taylor Swift, and he said yes, because my daughter's going to make me see Taylor Swift. Now, this is an interesting thing. And then Jimmy Fallon said to him, but, you know, there's a rumour that you might go on stage with her and she might go on stage with you. And he said very tellingly that Taylor Swift is welcome to join the E Street Band anytime. So that could be a real moment to see Bruce with somebody like Taylor Swift, who's very modern, you know, very much of this era. I mean, Ed Sheeran, brilliant songwriter, but people are very sniffy about him because he's like just this ginger kid with a guitar. I like him. I think he's a very, very good singer-songwriter. The Killers are a band I like of the current bands. But there's a backstory with The Killers and Springsteen in that Brandon Flowers, the lead singer of The Killers, his mum and dad are tramps. So they followed Springsteen all over America, all around the world over the years. So basically Brandon was reared with Springsteen as his soundtrack. Now, recently they got together and did a song which was absolutely brilliant. I think it's called American Dirt. And it's absolutely brilliant. But Bruce and Brandon, they gel vocally, if you know what I mean, because this song is written very much as if Springsteen wrote it, but it's written by Brandon Flowers deliberately for him and Springsteen to sing. So you're seeing a lot of these bands today. They are looking at the likes of Bruce for collaborations, which is great, I think, because it's two different musical eras combining to produce something a bit different, which is always good, I think, for music, Henry.
Yes, it's a generation merge when you think about it. Between, you know,
absolutely. I mean, people go on about, you know, when artists release duet records. For me, the most brilliant duet of all time, without a shadow of a doubt, is Bing Crosby and David Bowie.
Wow.
From 1978.
I've seen that. Yes.
I'm a Boy, He's on Earth.
That was a Christmas
Whoever
song.
Whoever came
yeah.
up with the idea of doing that was an absolute genius. Now, of course, as you are well aware, by the time this was released as a Christmas single and made number one, Bing was already dead.
Yes.
Because Bing recorded a Christmas special in 1978 in England in July, and then he died at the end of August, just a couple of weeks after Elvis Presley. So by the time this Christmas special was aired and the single was released, Bing was already dead. But it was just the juxtaposition of David Bowie's voice and Bing Crosby's voice. Now, Bing Crosby, for me, was another one who was one of the great interpreters of other people's songs. You had him, you had Frank Sinatra, you had Dean Martin. All of these guys knew how to sing a song.
Springsteen
is very, very similar in that way. If you listen to this new album, it's soul, it's R&B, it's stuff that he's been singing for 50 years. And his voice is, you can hear the joy in it when you listen to these tracks. You can see he's enjoying himself. I mean, he actually said that he produced another album and didn't like it, so he threw it away. He's done that a lot. There are a lot of albums sat there in Bruce's vault that, you know, he has stuff like, I mean, on his last album with the E Street Band, he put in two songs that he actually wrote in the early 70s, but had never put on a record.
Isn't that amazing, isn't it? Like 40 years later.
The fact that, you know, he has these things in his locker. And then there was an album called The Promise, which was all the outtakes from Darkness on the Edge of Town, the double album. So, you know, over the years, he's released a lot more. And of course, Bruce is very big on releasing his bootlegs officially. He releases his gigs as bootlegs, but they're official bootlegs from the Bruce Springsteen archives, if you like. So any gig that Bruce has ever done, you can probably get it perfectly legally through his website, which is absolutely brilliant.
And that is a beautiful thing, isn't it? Bob, we're running out of time. Our conversations are always fast and furious here on Bondi Tunes. Would you like to, I don't know what song you're going to pick of Bruce Springsteen's to go out with?
Well, I will pick one off of the new album, and it's called Do I Love You? Indeed I Do.
Come on!
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International Broadcasting around the world, and we welcome our listeners on FM in Australia and New Zealand. Melissa Grimmer is our correspondent in Melbourne here in Australia. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Henry. Hello, listeners.
I know that, you know, I was at a wedding 3 weeks ago, and you were at a wedding about the same time.
Yes, yes.
Everyone's getting married.
Very interesting. Yes. How old was your couple, Henry?
I don't actually know. The early 20s.
Oh, no. My friend got married and she was 54. First marriage for her.
Wow.
Bit of a love story there. So, as you know, I used to be a tour guide.
Yes.
And I probably know at least 30 plus female, ex-female tour leaders who have never been married or had kids. And I think it's because we're all kind of the strong, independent women type, and a lot of men don't know what to do with us.
Yeah, so they're afraid
of you. I think so. But I could rattle off about 30 of us over the age of 40. And we weren't always over the age of 40, but we've been single that long. And my friend Donna, she lived overseas and lived in Bali for about 10 years. And I worked with her in Thailand before that. And she'd met this guy when she was in high school on the CB radio, and they struck up a friendship over the CB. That was back in the days before Facebook, obviously.
Yes.
And this guy went off and got married and had kids, and she found his brother on Facebook years later and got in touch with Dave's then wife. And then Dave's wife unfortunately passed away from cancer. Dave and Donna reconnected, and the rest is history. And they got married. And for our listening audience in Europe, the married celebrant was someone very famous in Australia. And he turned up at the ceremony, and he said, "Hello, everybody. For anyone over the under the age of 40, you don't know who I am, but for everyone over the age of 40, yes, I am Greg Evans from Perfect Match, and no, Dexter's not here." So Greg Evans used to host a television show called A Perfect Match, a little bit like Cilla Black had that show in the UK. What was that called, Henry? Do you remember?
I do not remember, no.
Anyway, one of these TV love host shows, before all that awful reality Bachelor stuff set in. So anyway, it's quite funny that he was the host of the wedding, and everyone over the age of 40 was very excited. And being a former television host, he did an amazing job, and he was extremely funny. And the groom's son was deathly afraid of birds, and he told us he was deathly afraid of birds. He had a phobia. And then they put this glove on him, and he held his hand out, and then this owl came bearing the rings and landed on the
son. Oh, my God.
Yeah, so the ring bearer was an owl. It's very Harry Potter-ish.
It's very Harry Potter.
Yeah, imagine.
So it's interesting because I've been to a wedding about 3 weeks ago, and now I'm going to an engagement party on this coming Saturday. It seems like, you know, you talk about people over 40 getting married, but these are kids in their early 20s. It's like marriage is back in vogue. And I wonder, is it all to do with social media and, you know, getting drones over all the people at the wedding and showing your pictures, doing videos? Is it all kind of a reality TV thing?
I think there's always been like a section of people in society that get married young. That's, you know, especially, you know, growing up in the suburbs, I always knew it was a little bit different, Henry. You know, when my oldest friend got married, I think she was 23 at the time. And when she got married, you should have seen me. I was walking down the aisle sobbing hysterically. You know when someone's crying and they can't breathe because I was crying ugly tears as I walked down the aisle, and my dad was like, "What are you crying for, you idiot? This is the wedding, you're supposed to be happy." And I remember at the time thinking to myself, my friend is not in love with this man. She's getting married at the age of 23 because she thinks that's what she's supposed to do, and that's what comes next. And it wasn't until years later that's when I found out that's exactly why she got married. I didn't want to burst her bubble, you see, and say anything to her, because my reality and her reality are very different. But she said, Melissa, it's just what you did. And I think there's still a lot of kids with that mentality today. And I was at one of my brother's weddings, and someone who was at my brother's wedding that was at the other wedding said, Melissa, I've been to 1,000 weddings in my life. I've never seen anyone cry as much as you. You knew.
It's like you're my
brother getting divorced.
It was like you're at a funeral. Do you think her decision to marry so young, you mentioned, you know, she felt she had to, but was that on religious grounds or cultural grounds that you think that she felt she had to get married?
I don't think it was so much religious as it was cultural. Like, you know, my background's Maltese, and a lot of our family friends where I grew up were Maltese. And I see on Facebook the Maltese friends that I grew up with, their kids are getting married and they're in their early 20s. I think it's like it's a social norm. And, you know, she had a massive wedding with 300 people.
So that's a big wedding.
It's a huge wedding, but I think there's still a lot of, and you know, I don't want to sound like I'm stereotyping, but I think there's still a lot of kids out in the suburbs that want to get married, and they're kids that will, you know, go out, get married, have the wedding, fall pregnant straight away, and probably work in the same job for the next 30 years. And I don't say that to put someone down. I kind of envy people that are happy to do that. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Let me ask you, Melissa Greimer, if you were 23 and you fell in love, would you have got married?
I was 23 and fell in love, and no, I didn't get married. I went overseas on a trip to Malta, and I met a Maltese boy there. I had actually met him the first time I went to Malta when I was 17. So when I went back at 23, I saw him at a bar, and I was like, Joseph, how are you? And then we started dating, and you know, at 23, you get quite serious about someone, like, oh. And then we had the long distance relationship because I went to the UK, and then I went traveling, and then he came to Australia, and he met with me in Australia, and so we were kind of living together in Australia. And I actually went and applied for a de facto relationship status with the Australian government so he could stay in Australia. However, he was not a great boyfriend, and I didn't think he would make good marriage material. And I saw an advertisement for Intrepid to be a tour leader. So I applied for that job, became a tour leader. I left him in Australia and off I went. So no, at the age of 23, when I had the opportunity, I did not take it.
Did you ever track him down on social media?
Oh, no, we've been in contact the whole time. Like, he's still a friend of mine.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah. He's got two kids now. He's not married, but he's got two kids. He's living back in Malta. His partner is Spanish.
Right.
And he works for Ryanair. There, Henry. He works for Ryanair as a hostess.
Well, hopefully not a hostess. Well, not that there's anything wrong. Not that there's anything wrong with that. From Sydney, Australia, Henry O'Donovan on Bondi Tunes International. Melissa, you know, I think I need a jingle for you which sings Melissa Greimer's Love Life on Bondi Tunes. How's it going, your love life?
Well, I had a date recently, and it took me about a day to get over it. I was just very annoyed and very angry. And it kind of annoys me, Henry, that I'm in my 40s and men still act like teenage boys. And I don't know why I expect them to be any different. And of course, I don't mean all men, so I'm not man bashing. I'm sorry, guys out there. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to put you all down. I'm not. But
what happened to that situation?
So I've been talking to this guy online, and we were getting on really well, a lot of conversation. Like, sometimes when you're online, it can just be, how's your weekend? Oh, what did you get up to today? Good morning. Oh, give me a bullet. These are all beige flags. They talk about red flags, right? They talk about green flags, but there's beige flags. Beige is like the boring geez, shoot me now. But we had really good conversation. And then he was like, Melissa, I'm so sorry to tell you this, but one of the girls I've been seeing has decided that she wants to try and make a go of it with me. And then he said, Melissa, I've got to be honest with you. You know, I've been seeing four girls at the moment and they all know about each other. But no one's wanted to get serious, but I'm looking for an active relationship. And one of the girls said, no, let's give it a go. So I'm having to take myself off the market. And I said, oh, well, great for you. Bad timing for me. Here's my phone number. If anything changes, you feel free to use it. So he promptly messaged me on WhatsApp and we, you know, went with a bit of ping pong, you know, back and forth with intense messages, really enjoying the conversation, enjoying his company. And he said, why don't you, one Sunday, he said, come out with me and we'll have a pint at his local and my local's basically the same bar, like where he lives. So I went down on a Sunday. I was hungover and I thought, I can do a pint and a burger. I'm hungover. And I just went out with this guy thinking, like with no expectation, knowing that he was taken. And, you know, he said, let's go to another bar and see a band. So we went to another bar. And we were watching music, like watching this live band. And I can be a slow drinker. And he was really getting into the drinks, Henry. And he went outside, came back, and he goes, that's my drink. And I went, no, it's not. He goes, yes, it is. And I went, it's mine. And I said, I'll go and get you one. So I went and got him a drink, and he drank my drink when I was going to get for him. And I was like, dude, I didn't buy two drinks because I'm still going. And I don't want to be forced to drink fast. Anyway, he did this again, which was terribly unattractive, by the way. Indeed. Anyway, he wanted to kiss me. And I said, don't, you've got a girlfriend. Anyway, you know, we ended up making out. I'm not the one, I'm like, well, I'm not the one in a relationship that's doing anything. And then he said, oh, Melissa, this is so frustrating for me. You don't understand. And I went, I'm going to stop you right there. You have a girlfriend. And then he called me a tease. And I said, mister, I said, if anyone is the tease here, it's you, because you're taken and this can't go anywhere. So you're teasing me. And he insisted on seeing me home. And I said, no, why don't you stay here with your friend and I'll get my own Uber home. He's like, no. And so I got his phone and punched in my address, then his. So we were in the car, in the Uber going home, and we were kissing. And then he's like, oh, you're such a tease, Melissa. He said it again. And
there's something terribly wrong about that. And this is the whole blaming the victim kind of stuff, isn't it?
And this is when I lost I lost it. And I said, stop. You are not a 16-year-old boy and I'm not a 16-year-old girl, and you don't get to shame me into doing something because you're having this perception of me. Oh, it's all my fault. I'm such a tease for making you feel the way that you feel. You're a willing participant in this.
Yep. This is a very common thing, and it is being addressed with the Me Too movement and all that stuff. If you just joined us, I'm talking with Melissa Grima in Melbourne, our correspondent here. I want to ask you about a thing called ghosting, because I was just talking to someone about it the other day. Have you explain what it is for people like me who really don't understand this, and if you have had that experience?
Have I had that experience? My goodness, is the Pope Catholic, Henry? Jeez.
Yeah, okay.
So ghosting is a new form of breaking up with someone where you just disappear. You don't tell them that you're not going to see them again or that you don't want to see them again. You just stop communicating with them altogether. So you don't answer their facts. Sorry, facts, gosh. The reason why I'm saying facts is because when I hear the term ghosting, it reminds me of a story that I heard about Phil Collins. And this was back in the early 90s or the mid 90s, about 94, 95. Fax machines had just become the whole rage. And apparently Phil Collins had broken up with his Wi-Fi fax.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah. That's not exactly ghosting, because at least he let her know. That wasn't a good way of letting her know. But ghosting is when you just disappear, you know. And I often think of Casper the Friendly Ghost. There's nothing friendly about ghosting someone in the dating world, because you know, I've had guys that I was seeing, and I'm talking guys that I've had sleepovers with, and you know, they've hung out at my house, and we've been together for 6 weeks or something, and they just ghosted me. No explanation, no, Melissa, it's been fun. Sorry, I don't want to go through this. I don't want to do this anymore. None of that. Just don't. They just stop responding to messages.
Okay, now what is this about? Is it about cowardice? And the other thing I want to ask you is that, you know, this might be a rhetorical question. Do girls must do ghosting to guys as well? Or do they?
Yes. Yes. No, they do. So for me, there's a couple of forms of ghosting, right? Like, you might say that I've been guilty of ghosting if I'm talking to someone on online dating and I don't think they're the right fit for me. Sometimes I'll just unmatch them. I don't see anything wrong with that. I don't consider that to be ghosting because you haven't actually met in person. So I think it's fine if you want to drop out of a conversation. I don't consider it to be ghosting if you've had one date with someone and nothing happened on that date and you don't want to take it further. You know, sometimes you don't always need to address why you're not interested in someone unless, of course, they ask. But if you did go on a date and then after the date, say I went on a date with a guy called, I don't know, Jonathan. And then after the date, I said, "Hi, Jonathan. I had a really good time the other night. I'd love to see you again." Now, if he didn't get back to you, that's ghosting. But if neither of you wrote back to each other, then that's just, hey, neither of you are feeling it. You know?
I just don't understand why people need to do that. I mean, it's lazy. It's cowardice, as I mentioned earlier on. It's totally unnecessary. It seems very selfish to me, you know.
Henry, it's extremely hurtful, right? It's happened to me by at least two guys that I was seeing for, you know, a couple of months apiece that just up and ghosted me one day. And I sent messages and I said, "Listen, if you're not interested, you're not interested, but could you just let me know and tell me?" Because I need closure. And it's so, like, it's really hurtful.
But
and
you're left up in the air, aren't you? I mean, you're thinking, is this person ever going to contact me again? Or you're waiting by your phone, to use an old-fashioned term. You're waiting probably by your, you know, by your Skype by or whatever.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's really, really horrible. It's such, like, you do feel really rejected. And then it's like, so I meant nothing to you at all, that I'm not even a consideration for you. Like, if there's
it's almost like slapping you across the face, isn't it? And running.
It's worse because you didn't even care to slap me.
Yes, good point.
You know, yeah. At least if you slapped me, then I would know that you were annoyed or I'd angered you or I'd done something. I'd invoked some emotion, but there's no emotion there. It's like dead wall. That's why it's called ghosting, because you're dead to that person, you know?
It's a terrible thing.
It's a horrible thing.
Can I ask you, sorry to interrupt you. We've got a time delay on this. We've got about 10 minutes left. I just want to ask you, are you tired of this? Are you tired? Are you exhausted in this whole world of looking for a mate for life, using all the modern utilities, you know, whole works, all these agencies online? Do you ever think, oh, God, this is just too much?
I'm at a point, it's very frustrating. Henry is a friend of mine on social media, and I'll often post funny anecdotes about my dating life, which, you know, people can see the funny side. And I've got a lot of single female friends, a lot of them ex-tour leaders, and the comments that I get on my posts are like, "Melissa, I don't know how you're still going. I gave up dating a long time ago." Like, it is so tiring. I feel like I've turned a corner. In like, the longer you do it, the more kind of immune you get, or the more of an armor that you build up.
What do you think of the old-fashioned business of, you know, when I was young and single, I'd go to the bar. Is that sort of, you know, go to the pub, meet up with girls in my case, is that sort of getting out of vogue now? Because I have spoken to a lot of people, and even friends of mine have, you know, have met their partners. A number of them actually have met their partners online. They both got married. In the cases I'm talking about, they both have children. It all happened online. And they went online because they said they weren't able to meet people in pubs anymore as single people. Do you think it's just like a thing of the past, this whole business of meeting in pubs and actually talking to people face, you know, face to face without having to go through all the paraphernalia of technology before it?
Situations and circumstances have changed. Like, I got hit on at my friend's wedding on the dance floor, but the kid was 23. If I was attracted to this kid, I would have gone there. He wasn't the type of guy that I would have probably, you know, been attracted to when I was 23 anyway. I do get spoken to a lot at bars because I'm a social person. But this is the problem, right? I got chatting to one guy after a gig one night. He was 60. You know, I'm in my 40s. And then he was like, right, we're going home together. Yeah, I'm coming back to your house. I went, excuse me? And he's like, you're not interested? And I said, well, I don't do one-night stands. So it's very, you know, you're making a lot of assumptions that I'm going to take you home. And he said, what did you talk to me for so long for? I thought, oh, my goodness. We were just having a drink and a good conversation, right? I still do get approached at bars, but the guys are either too young, right? Mm-hmm. And they're in their 20s and, you know, oh, older lady, woohoo. or maybe they're too old and I'm not interested in them. Or this is what happens to me a lot. I go out and the weeknights are great nights to talk to people because bars aren't that full. People are there after work. They're having a few drinks on a Wednesday night or a Thursday night. I've gone on to have some really random evenings on a weeknight, right? But they're usually married, you know.
Yeah. What can you do?
So you can still meet people out, but when you're older, there's less people your age that go out. And so, like, I was talking to this guy online on the weekend and he'd sent me this text at 7 in the morning and I replied at 1 o'clock and I said, oh, I'm in bed, like, and I said, oh, to put into context, I didn't go to bed till 5 a.m. this morning and I'm only just waking up. And he was a few years older than me, like 3 or 4, and he said, why? And he goes, I've been up at the beach with my son. And I went, because I was out last night. You know, like, I'm still going out. And that was so foreign to him, you know. And that's the other issue I have too. Like, guys that have been out of the game for a long time, they're not used to the lifestyle that I lead. And I still lead a life like I did when I was 20. Not exactly, but very similar in terms of
and also in the case of this guy, he has children, and you know, I've never had children, neither have you so far. And the thing is, once you have children, you don't sleep much anymore.
Well, we don't sleep anyway, Henry, so you know.
Yes, this is true. We've talked about this at length, haven't we?
So big difference. I was waiting for this post-COVID rush. Right. I thought, okay, now COVID's going to break a lot of relationships up and there's going to be all these single men that are flooding onto the market. And because they've been in long-term relationships, they're going to be the type that, you know, are ready for relationships and whatever else. So I was waiting and then I'm online and the guys start chatting to you and you can tell that they're new and they've been married for a long time or in a long-term relationship.
Sorry to interrupt you, but why do you think COVID has resulted in a lot of people breaking up?
Oh, everyone forced to be stuck in lockdown, especially in Victoria. That made or break a lot of relationships. You know, even after the first two lockdowns, marriages that weren't great, like broke up. I think there were like two consequences of lockdown: breakups or babies.
Gosh, Yes. I think they thought that there would be an increase in babies, but it apparently didn't happen.
Interesting. Well, now that there's a lot of guys who are single that have broken up just like, you know, just before lockdown or during lockdown, and it's like, you know, a kid on training wheels. Yeah, they're learning to ride the bike for the first time.
Yeah, it's a good point, isn't it? And also, Melissa, things have changed since they were, in the early 20s or whatever. The whole system has changed. Their attitudes are kind of old-fashioned, maybe, by comparison to kids in their 20s.
Yeah, they're like deer in the headlights, yes. You know.
Yes.
And I did go on a date with someone that was like that, and we got on really well, and we had a great first date, and I was the first date he'd been on, and he was just like, wow. And I said, dude, it's not like this with everyone. I'm just giving you the pretext. Like, I'm just letting you know. And then he really didn't know what he wanted, and such an idiot. Now, he didn't ghost me, but the way he told me that he didn't want to see me anymore, I just thought, dude, you should have thought that through a little bit better.
Mm.
He said, I'm going to keep looking. I'm going to keep exploring my options.
You mentioned earlier on that these kids look at you and you're a little older than them. Do you think they're kind of just looking for one-night stands rather than a relationship? I mean, that's probably a rhetorical question as well. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, a lot of guys don't. There's younger guys don't realise my age, which isn't a bad thing.
Well, you don't look your age, you see.
Oh, thank you, Henry. But, if you're at a bar, they're only after one thing. You know, and what I'll do is sometimes I've got my age on one of the dating apps set really low. And when I say low, I like 25 or something, right? So once recently, I just swiped right on every single 25-plus-year-old that I came across. And every single guy had swiped on me, every single 25-year-old, 28-year-old, you know. I don't think they're looking for a long-term relationship. And then on another app, I changed my dating preference to not have an age limit, and my inbox got bombarded with, 65-plus-year-olds who wanted to take me out. And
fascinating stuff.
I'm just going to date a 60-plus-year-old, Henry.
Yeah.
You know, 50 feels a bit old for me.
It's just amazing how you can do all this kind of stuff. Melissa, we're so out of time. It's always fantastic to talk to you. Thank you for joining me here on Bondi Tunes.
Thank you for having me, Henry.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.
Dreams of war, dreams of lies, dreams of dragons, fire, and of things that The sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.